everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's January 2025, and this is episode 430, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the Disney Plus Star Wars series, Skeleton Key. Today's guest is Cole Burgett. He is a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and the Moody Bible Institute. He teaches systematic theology and Bible exposition classes and writes extensively about theology and popular culture. Cole has written a TV series review for the Christian Research Journal, and his review is called Space Pirates and Treasure Planets, a review of Star Wars Skeleton Crew, and you can read it for free at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Cole, it's good to have you on the podcast.
It's always good to be here. Thank you.
Well, today, as I mentioned, we are talking about the brand new series streaming on Disney Plus that is in the Star Wars universe, and it's called Skeleton Crew. But before I talk to Cole about that, he has covered some other things in the Star Wars universe for us. And really, it's just been such an enduring property since it first came on the scene in 1977 and just has obviously spawned just worldwide, not just fans, but a whole industrial complex worth many billions of dollars. And, you know, I always ask Cole this, if some folks don't regularly listen to our installments here on the podcast dealing with pop culture, but I do ask him about the value of watching, you know, pop culture creations, not just for us, but what about our kids? Should we be concerned that, you know, our kids are watching the latest, you know, whatever it is, streaming series, because kids have so much more access to culture and TV and movies than they did in the past because of streaming platforms like Disney Plus. So, you know, first of all, you know, as I mentioned, it's an enduring property. What makes Star Wars keep going since it was, you know, came on the scene more than 40 years ago? And then also, you know, why do Christians engage with it and should they care about it?
So broadly speaking with Star Wars, part of the appeal of that is baked into the originals or what Lucas set out to do. I guess if we're talking about a hermeneutic of Star Wars, this is the part that we would call authorial intent. Lucas set out to create a sort of modern mythology. He explains this quite well in a 2015 interview he gave with Charlie Rose. And in that interview, he talks about how he wanted to create a property that would appeal to adolescents, to what he said specifically was like 12-year-olds. And as far as Lucas was concerned, because he was friends with Joseph Campbell, the scholar who wrote on mythology, who wrote the book Here with a Thousand Faces, that kind of thing. Lucas, in talking with Campbell, set out to create a basic mythology for the 20th century, going into the 21st century. And one of the things he observes in that article is, you know, according to him, we don't really do that kind of thing anymore. He said the last time that we were doing that, right, creating a mythology, was with Westerns. And those, you know, were by the 50s, were a thing of the past. And so according to Lucas, we didn't really have a national mythology, very similar to what Tolkien did with The Lord of the Rings and Britain. That idea of, well, we don't have a national mythology ourselves, I'm going to make this. And that was what Lucas tried to do. And according to him, you know, he wanted to make a kids film that would strengthen contemporary mythology and introduce a kind of basic morality, which in Star Wars plays itself out as the light side, the dark side, that sort of a thing. That quote actually about him wanting to make a contemporary mythology and introduce a basic morality, that comes from Del Pollock's biography of him called Skywalking, The Life and Films of George Lucas. So, why is Star Wars so enduring in that sense? That's why. Because it is fundamentally a mythic story. and mythic stories endure, and not only do they endure, but they appeal to different generations. And that's what Star Wars is. It is a generational story. The first six films that Lucas made, it follows the life trajectory of one character, and then the last three, or the original three, transition to follow the life story of another character who is tied to the character from the first three, or the prequel trilogy. And of course, when we get to the sequel trilogy, which was created under Lucasfilm under Disney, it's the same deal. It continues that narrative. It follows a new generation of heroes who are tied to those that came before. So Star Wars is a generational story, and it endures. And, you know, this has often caused debates among fans and things like that. But just to give you an illustration, I have a friend whose daughter loves Star Wars, and she's 6, 7, somewhere in there, 8 maybe. And she loves Rey. And what's funny is, you know, I have other friends who look at the new characters, this new generation of heroes, and they can't stand it. They think it's the worst thing ever because it's not quote unquote their Star Wars. Well, you give that little girl 15 years with her friends, and, you know, everybody else is going to be the old fogies, you know, complaining about, you know, back in my day. And to this girl and her friends, you know, these new characters are going to be it. That's their Star Wars. And then whatever they come out with in 30 years, that girl and her friends are going to look at it and go, what is this nonsense? this isn't what it was like when I was a kid. And so that's part of the enduring appeal of Star Wars, is that it is a mythic story that is primarily geared toward kids. And if you discover Star Wars at just the right age, you know, 12, right around there, it really does have a kind of a transformative power, which is why you get so invested in it. I was actually talking with a filmmaker friend of mine just last night, because we were debriefing about Skeleton Crew. And that my friend, he had a very visceral reaction to The Last Jedi. And actually, that's what we were talking about, is he was very angry, very, very angry about that film, which a lot of fans were. And it to the point where he was literally throwing Star Wars things away after that film came out. And we were talking very lightheartedly, but also kind of seriously about, you know, where does that anger come from? Why did you have such a visceral reaction? And as we were talking, one of the things I said is, you know, I understand your feelings about Luke's character in The Last Jedi. I said, because you came to Star Wars as a kid, it changed you in a lot of ways. And so it's not like when you see Luke fail, it's not the same as seeing any other movie character fail because of that emotional attachment you have. The way that we like it is it was almost sort of like finding out that your dad was having an affair, right? You have such an emotional investment in those characters because you encountered them when you were so young, and it imprinted on you so strongly, that to find out your hero has feet of clay is not like any other movie experience. It cuts close to home for a lot of people. And so that's why I think Star Wars is such an enduring and popular property.
So what about for Christians? You know, a lot of people wonder if, especially not all Christians are into sci-fi. My older sons know some people who've never seen Star Wars their age, in their 20s. So, but for some Christians, it has made an impact. Why do you think it has, and should Christians even care about Star Wars?
Well, it's sort of the same answer we've just discussed, because it is a mythic story. And you and I have talked on this podcast at length about the importance of myth when it comes to the Christian life. And, you know, sort of the same thing we say every time. When we say the word myth, what we're not talking about is fake. That's not what we mean. Oftentimes that word myth is used today to mean something fake, and that's not quite what we mean. We mean mythic in the sense that it deals with universal themes that are common to the human experience. In that sense, we would say that scripture is a mythic story. It has something to say about people, and it you can connect in very obvious and baseline morality kinds of ways with what it is doing. This was ultimately, as we've said before, the thing that actually converted C.S. Lewis, in part due to his conversations with Tolkien and Dyson. There is no coincidence that the great fantasy makers of the 20th century were in fact Christians, because they were mythic in the way that they thought about and approached the Bible story. They believed that it actually had something to say. And why should Christians care about this? Because what we don't often realize, especially in a Western culture that is so rational and grounded in empiricism, is that what, and Lewis figured this out to his credit, that narrative, stories, myth, it has a way of bypassing logic, bypassing the rational part of the brain, the thing that would normally give a person who is trying to think their way into the Christian faith, the mythic components of the biblical story, right? The God who reaches down into humanity, that sort of a thing. The narrative, the imagination is what is queued up. And that has a way of bypassing sort of those natural logical hiccups of someone who is trying to rationalize away the Christian faith. And by the way, Jesus, I think this is always worth pointing out, Jesus himself sort of understands the mental roadblocks, because he says as much to Thomas, right? You believe because you see, but blessed are those who are never going to see and still believe. So Jesus understands. He gets the difficulty that many, many people have in trying to wrap their mind around the Christian faith. That being said, the mythic dimensions of the story sort of help bypass the rational parts of it. And that's not to say that Christianity is illogical, because it's not, but it has to be a logic within its own framework. It has to be a logic that begins with the presuppositions based on the authority of Scripture versus the presuppositions of, well, my view of the world is right and everything I interpret through my lens is how it has to be. Those two things are fundamentally at odds with each other. So I would say in that regard, Star Wars is actually a very important property because of what Lucas set out to do, which was, in his own words, establish a national mythology and set a kind of baseline morality for kids. If that is the case, and Star Wars is as popular as it is, and newsflash, it is, then it is a property, at the very least, you should be, as a Christian, familiar with. Because, especially as a parent, your kids, whether you like it or not, are going to encounter someone. I mean, it's just statistics at that point, are going to encounter someone in school or in their early life who is, in fact, a serious fan of Star Wars, and introduce them to at least some of those ideas. And this day and age, there is such a cultural awareness of Star Wars that you're not actually going to get away from it. So understanding why so many people gravitate toward this property, again, in the ways that I described about my filmmaker friend, gravitate toward this property with more than just a, oh yeah, it's there, but with a serious kind of emotional investment, I think is very important, not just for Christians to be aware of, but also for Christians who are interested in doing cultural apologetics. There are very few cultural artifacts. I would argue that there, at least from a secular standpoint, there is no other cultural artifact that we have today from a movie standpoint that has the kind, that wields the kind of power that it does over the zeitgeist, over the collective consciousness.
Almost worldwide, I would say.
It is. There is no other cultural artifact that has that kind of power like Star Wars. There are reasons for that. And a lot of that has to do with mythology and mythic storytelling. So that is why Christians should at the very least be aware of Star Wars as a property and what it's trying to do.
So let me ask you specifically about Skeleton Crew. As I mentioned, it's streaming on Disney Plus. So is it more family friendly?
Yeah, well, I would say, you know, Star Wars has always been family friendly. If we're talking about, you know, kids around 12, you know, 13, that sort of thing, Star Wars has always been for kids I think that maybe the one caveat there is the show Andor, which we covered on this podcast. That's a little different. The goal there was a little different, but of course that's not one of the films, the mainline films. It's a TV series. Skeleton Crew is quite family friendly. I would say it's far more accessible to kids than even a show like Ahsoka or Andor or even The Mandalorian, because Skeleton Crew follows for kids who and it's a very traditional story, who make this discovery.
It's kind of like Goonies, like an old
school. It is. That's I was going to make that connection. Yeah. It really feels a bit like Star Wars as done by Steven Spielberg. It's a Goonies-esque story about these four kids who make this discovery on their home planet. There will be spoilers throughout this, I'm sure, but the discovery is a starship. They discover a starship that takes them off world, and suddenly they get lost, literally lost in space, lost in this strange galaxy as they try to find their way back home. But they meet all of these pirate-esque characters along the way. So it's very piratey, which is very, you know, Goonies-like. All of those ingredients are in there, but it really is this story about these four kids who get lost in space and then try to find their way home again. And the allies and the bad guys they meet along the way. So very traditional story, very accessible for kids. But here's what I would say. I would say that just because it is a story with kids, and I would say primarily more geared toward kids, it is adults can still find a lot to enjoy there. I watched it. Now, let me be the first to say, I am a sucker for coming of age films. The film Stand By Me is my favorite film. The Rob Reiner 1986 movie. That's mine. So, you know, tell me that Star Wars is going to do a movie about four kids going on an adventure, and you've got me right there. So I grant that that's sort of my bias toward those kinds of stories. I'll be there and I'll watch them. But I actually did find, you know, it to be fairly well made. And especially because the big star of the show, I'll say it that way, even though the kids are the protagonists, the big star is Jude Law's character, which we'll talk about later. And so with a character like that, it certainly makes it more accessible and palatable for adults as well.
I kind of felt like it had a Goonies vibe, but also like a very wholesome Pirates of the Caribbean kind of vibe, because we, you know, there's pirates in it, but it's very wholesome. It's not dark in any way.
Yeah. I would say there are moments of darkness in terms of character beats, but it doesn't come at the expense of the overriding sense of, and I think that's a good word for it, wholesomeness, that it portrays. And the characters are likable. The kids are likable. They go through their struggles. They go through their development. But at no point do you get the sense that this is a disingenuous or ironic Star Wars story. And that's one of the things I actually really appreciated about it. In many ways, I felt like these guys get what Lucas wanted to do with Star Wars originally. And they just heighten that by actually making kids the main characters, because they don't, in some ways, I think this show is probably going to land a little differently for people, because we do live in such a culture that focuses on meta-modern storytelling. We do live in a culture that prioritizes irony and gags and things like that over very sincere storytelling. And that's not to say that there's no comedy here. There is, and it's great. But it is a very, very sincere story that takes these kids on a journey, not just physically, but also emotionally. And so there's a large amount of pathos there. And I think it's pretty worthwhile. Yeah.
We are committed to having our content be free, 24/7, 365 to anybody around the world. And that means that when we transitioned to become a fully online magazine, we decided to get rid of paid subscriptions because we wanted our content to be widely available and read and shared. But we still need you to partner with us in a variety of ways. And the biggest way that you can help us really on the internet is to rate and review. And probably the best place to do that is Apple Podcasts, because I think I mentioned in another episode, did you know that 60% of the people who listen to podcasts listen either on Apple or Spotify? Apple's the number two. And so if you can go on there and give us a rating and review, that would be great. Specifically, a review, because people can see what other folks think about this podcast, why they listen, and it's just a short sentence or two. And right now we have 85 ratings and reviews, and I would like to make it 90 this year. I mean, 100 I think would be too big of a goal, but just five more would be amazing. The last one we had was in July of 2024, so it's been a while. And if you could please take the time to do that, we'd be really grateful. Also, if you could also to give us a tip for our content, we would be so grateful. And how you do that is go onto equip.org, click journal, then click Postmodern Realities Podcast. All of our episodes are housed there. Click on any episode and you will see a link where you could give us a tip. So thanks for supporting our show in very practical ways and all of our content. And now back to more on Star Wars Skeleton Key. So what makes this particular series a little bit different, you mentioned Andor, than most of the Star Wars media that's being released these days? And where is it in the timeline, the familiar timeline that we all know, like, you know, Luke and Leia and, you know, Darth Vader and those kinds of things? Even if no one's ever seen Star Wars, they've heard of Luke and Leia and Darth Vader and Han Solo.
Yeah. So Skeleton Crew is set in what is now being referred to as the New Republic era. So if you're a Star Wars nerd like me, and you try to keep up with the timeline, one of the things that you'll figure out fairly quickly is that Star Wars, it suitably has a grand narrative. It is a huge sprawling story. And so there is I think on screen, there is a period of about 100 years that you can fall on that timeline somewhere. And if you count the Acolyte, you'll go back even 100 years before that. So, you know, where are we falling in that timeline? The movies, you know, the core films, you're looking at about a 70 year gap. And so you're always sort of, okay, when a new show comes out, where are we on this? And Skeleton Crew is set in what is referred to as the New Republic era. So this is going to be the period of time after Episode 6, Return of the Jedi, but before Episode 7, The Force Awakens.
Is it during the Mandalorian time?
Yes. Yeah. It's in the same time frame as The Mandalorian and Ahsoka. So you'll see some references throughout the show to the New Republic. You'll see some references to the X-Wing patrols, which we've seen in The Mandalorian and things like that. I think the specific year it's about 5 years after the events of Return of the Jedi. So we're looking at about 9 years. If there's an internal dating system that Star Wars uses, at least the fans use, where we date things as before the Battle of Yavin and then after the Battle of Yavin. So those are the events of the original film, right? The Battle of Yavin, when the Death Star shows up, all that kind of stuff. So this movie, in the internal chronology, this TV show is set around nine years after the Battle of Yavin. So 5 years after Return of the Jedi. And what makes the show quite different is that it, not only do we have a central focus on kids, but it also tells a very different kind of story that nevertheless feels right at home in Star Wars. This feels like a very Star Wars show, and it very much is a kind of let's say treasure hunt story, which we mentioned the pirate themes and pirate vibes earlier, but it very much is a kind of treasure hunt story where it's taking these kids out into the galaxy. So in that sense, it is similar to something like A New Hope, right? Or the Phantom Menace, about this kid, or even The Force Awakens, this young person who steps out on their own into a larger galaxy. But what makes this story unique among Star Wars media is the way that it sort of threads together different timelines. So there's a lot of talk in this show about the Old Republic. And of course, what's revealed to the kids about where they're from is that the planet they were originally from, this planet called Ad-Atten, used to be one of these great planets from the Old Republic that was responsible for creating mint currency. When the Republic fell, going into the decline, this planet with some others were hidden away. And so the kids are sort of going out into a galaxy that they didn't even know existed, because everything on their planet is so controlled so that they wouldn't know about the broader galaxy. I mean, they had some stories and they had some ideas, but they didn't know that it was so easily accessible, or that there were starships that just went anywhere and you had the whole galaxy at your fingertips. So it's unique in that sense. It's a unique sort of coming of age story for Star Wars that nevertheless feels right at home in Star Wars, if that makes sense.
So you also mentioned that there's pirates in the story. I said it's kind of like a wholesome Pirates of the Caribbean. So does that mean that it fits with this introduction of pirates kind of neatly within the whole Star Wars universe? Or are there some different inspirations maybe behind this particular series that they kind of push through with this thing that's not just like the typical Jedi? And I would say that for Andor too. There's like no Jedi in Andor, but yet it fits into the Star Wars series.
Yeah, the whole pirate angle, and this might fly past you if you've only ever been like tangentially connected to Star Wars. But part of Lucas's inspiration, it was these old like Saturday morning adventure serials. Lucas grew up in the 50s and 60s, which was the era that television was becoming the dominant form of entertainment. So you had shows like The Lone Ranger, Zorro, The Adventures of Superman, that were carrying forward the spirit of the old 30s and 40s adventure serials that Lucas admired. Shows like Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers, that kind of a thing. And those adventure serials were these short little episodic stories that didn't really complicate things. They were, you know, the heroes were dashing, the rescues were daring, the villains were mustache twirling and evil, and each one had this sort of cliffhanger ending. This is why, if you've ever wondered why Star Wars starts with, like, the movies start with that classic text crawl up the screen and then jumping into the action. Well, that's why. It's Lucas, he's like tipping his hat to those serials. And so Lucas was very inspired by those kinds of what I would call sort of swashbuckling tales, right? The swashbucklers of old. The old pirate stories, the pirate movies like those with Errol Flynn, the Robin Hood, that kind of a thing. There's just this sense of not taking itself too seriously, but still telling a very sincere story with very clear-cut good guys and bad guys. And so there's all this adventure to be had. And so those were all part and parcel to Lucas's inspirations to Star Wars. Han Solo is a sort of blend between, you know, outlaw, gunslinger / pirate type character. So there's always been that sort of, you know, the starships are just, you know, floating upon the oceans of space. There are pirate raids and those sorts of things that are all throughout Star Wars. And of course, you get the great lightsaber fights, right? It's just like the sword fights in old movies, just done differently, that kind of a thing. So as a pirate story, does Skeleton Crew fit neatly within Star Wars? Yeah, actually. And if you've watched any of the TV shows like Rebels or the Clone Wars, there are characters that are pirates in there.
Yeah, like, I'm not an animation person, but my kids love them when they came out.
Yeah, there are some pretty iconic pirate characters in there, like Hondo Ohnaka, those sorts of characters. And so, yeah, I think it fits quite neatly within Star Wars, and it taps into inspirations that have been there all along that maybe just haven't been brought out as much. But this is through and through a pirate story. I think that's actually one of the things that makes it unique as well, is that this leans hard into pirate territory to the point where it takes its cues from those kinds of things. So because I'm a nerd for this sort of thing, I was very careful to look at the blaster designs, and a lot of them are modeled after what look like old flintlocks, which we just haven't seen in Star Wars before. Normally, you know, the blasters like Han's, it sort of has that cowboy six shooter revolver Colt 45 look to it. But here we have these blasters that sort of look like flintlocks, and they're very it's very pirate inspired. So you knew a lightsaber would come into play, because what's a good pirate story without a sword? So you knew that was going to come up. But I do think it fits neatly within Star Wars and taps into some of those old inspirations. Yeah.
Well, that makes me think of the main kind of draw. Without, you know, these kids are like unknown actors, but Jude Law is a very famous actor from England, and he plays this character named Jod. And who is this character? And is he kind of different than the normal character that we're used to seeing in Star Wars, like the movies? I think I put him not in the same lane because of his motivations, but I kind of see him as in the same kind of overall genre as The Mandalorian, maybe?
Well, you asked the question, who is he? And the short answer is we don't know. That's actually part of the appeal of the show, is I think by the time the show is done,
it's all what he tells us at the end.
Yeah, exactly. By the time the show is done, I think he has what, six different aliases, six different names that he's gone through. And you're never really, I think, told specifically which name is real. I think Jod is the name that we're all sort of going with, but who knows, that could change later on. The character of Jod is fascinating, and he is played by Jude Law, and the character has been getting a lot of acclaim. And he's so different from what we're used to seeing, because he is this sort of wily character. And there are traces of like Han Solo in the character of Jod, but well, it's
I felt like he was kind of Mandalorian-ish in that, if you believe his backstory. When he says his backstory, it reminds me of Mandalorians.
Yes. Yeah, it is. And the Mandalorian also has the Han Solo gunslinger DNA tied into him. But it's to me, the character of Jod is like Han Solo only pursuing his most basic instincts. It's Han who doesn't come back at the end of A New Hope to rescue the rebellion. It's Han who doesn't let himself get drawn into the rebel conflict. It's a guy who's just out for himself, and it doesn't matter. You know, kind of like when we first meet Han, when on the Death Star, when Luke tells him, you know, the princess is here, they're going to kill her. And Han goes, yeah, well, better her than me. This is a guy who never changes from that. And so Jod sticks to his guns, no pun intended. And we first meet him as the captain of this pirate crew who is deposed. And his lieutenant, who is the species is called Shishtaven, and it's a throwback to the makeup design that was used in the original cantina in A New Hope, this sort of wolfman looking creature. But Jod he's deposed after his lieutenant, this Shishtaven named Brutus, leads a mutiny against him. And it's in prison that he encounters the four kids. The four kids sort of cross Jod's path, and he sees them as a chance to get out. He sees them as a chance to escape. What's interesting about Jod is that we learn, and this is like the first thing we learn about him, is that he's actually force sensitive. So he's someone who can use the force. And so the kids, in their naivety, and because they don't know anything about the galaxy, immediately assume, oh, this guy can use the force. He must be a Jedi. Therefore, he's a good guy. Let's go with him. But then as you watch the show, you realize it's not quite that simple. He's actually not a Jedi. He's force sensitive, but he's a pirate at heart. And he, you know, he has his moments of glimmers of maybe he'll do the right thing. And, you know, when the kids are really struggling in those middle episodes and going through their character development, he sort of in some interesting ways offers advice and things like that. But at the end of the day, he is not what we would call a heroic character. He is a villain. And we really don't see a lot of that type of character in Star Wars, who has, you know, most of these characters have a redemption arc. Han has a redemption arc. He comes back at the end. The Mandalorian has a redemption arc. He chooses to help the child. This guy does not have one. And that's part of what makes him so unique among Star Wars characters, especially primary Star Wars characters, is that he doubles down on his worst tendencies. And there is no redemption for this character. He goes for it. What he feels he needs to in order to make it rich and to pull off his heist. So it's interesting to see and it played very well, for the record by Jude Law, who is getting a lot of acclaim for the performance. I've seen some rumblings online about putting him up for, some awards in the next award season. And I think it's likely. So
I want to talk a little bit about the themes in Skeleton Crew, and kind of there is this idea I see of mentorship between some of the younger and older characters. And then also you said that, you know, they meet in prison, but even though, you know, they're off world and they've never been exposed to anything. That's kind of the backdrop of these kids. So what kind of influence does someone like him have over them? Because really they're put into situations where they've just played make-believe. They've never come into contact with any, they think their life on at Atten is very boring. And so they've never been put into ethical situations, I guess, that they suddenly find themselves thrust in, especially when they go into some other worlds and meet other young kids too. They just haven't seen a concept of war, for example.
Yeah, this idea of mentorship. So one of the things that the show does quite well is it contrasts sort of the kids' parents with Jod. And that's one of the interesting things that happens in those early episodes. The kids' parents do love them, sure, but they're very detached, especially, you know, who we could argue is sort of the main kid you're following, Wim. His dad cares about him, but he's a workaholic and dad is never home. And so there's not the attention there that is needed. And what's interesting about when they meet Jod, he sort of gives them that attention. Now, of course, this is all to his own ends and he's scheming in the background the whole time. And this is where their naivete gets the better of them. Though they catch on pretty quickly. Their naivety gets the better of them, where he sort of steps into the role of mentor. And there's a great scene between them, between Wim, this boy, and Jod, where once they sort of make their one of their initial escapes, Wim, you know, he sort of has this moment where he's processing and he realizes, oh, wait a minute, that was actually kind of dangerous. Like we could have died in that situation. And so he has a very visceral reaction and he sort of goes off on his own and he's thinking you know, I miss home. I would like to talk to my dad, but my dad's not here, and that sort of a thing. And Jod sort of sits down and talks with him and gives him some advice. Now, the advice he gives him is horrible. Horrible. But he was there to listen, and he, to a degree, I think you see him empathize with the boy. And that's one of the things the show does well is highlight, you know, if as a parent, you know, if you're not going to be there to teach your kid, someone else is going to teach them for you. And that's exactly what you see happening with Wim. Had his dad not been keeping all of these, you know, secrets about the galaxy from him, had his dad been more available, more emotionally available, would Wim have even had the drive to leave in the first place, to sneak around and do that sort of thing? Because that's what he does. And then he meets Jod, and Jod steps in and becomes almost a kind of surrogate for a period of time. And even if the lessons he's teaching the kids don't come with the best morals, there are still lessons that the kids are learning. The kids are figuring out, okay, the galaxy is not all roses and daisies. There actually are people out here who will take advantage of you. I think one of the ideas, if you're looking at it from a Christian perspective, what is one of the ideas that the show highlights that Christians can really gravitate toward? It is that idea of mentorship, idea of older characters mentoring younger characters, and showing just how much influence whether they're wise or cunning. There's a fine line between wise and cunning, and whether they're wiser or whether they're a more cunning individual, they're nevertheless going to be able to influence the innocence of kids, and you want that done in the best way possible.
So I was talking about that they had different struggles, you know, when they go off world and they're the children and they're kind of exposed to things they hadn't been exposed to before. Do you think that those things are realistic for them? I mean, does it seem like this is kind of a coming of age story? I feel like it's a little bit younger than a coming of age story, but also, you know, they're really dealing with some ethical issues that they're trying to parse out. It's not just a kind of a adventure story, which it is, but they are faced with some very real adult situations. And like I said, things where they have morality, issues of morality that they just never dealt with before on their planet.
Yeah, that's sort of where the series mines its drama from. The struggles and growth that these characters go through, even though it is set, you know, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, they are real in that sense. They are relatable. And I think you raise an interesting point. It's a little, or is it too young as a coming of age story? I think it sort of depends on how you look at a coming of age story. If a coming of age story is being approached from the perspective of it's about a kid transitioning from child to adulthood, that sort of thing, like Stand By Me, the kids are a little older than this. But if you're approaching a coming of age story as a loss of innocence story, then this slots into that, because that's essentially what it is. The kids end up in the galaxy, not total idiots, but very trusting. They end up out there, you know, full of sort of that innocent sense of wonder. And Wim is, you know, Wim especially has grown up reading these stories about Jedi. And so, you know, when he meets Jod, he sees him use the Force, he immediately assumes, oh, you must be a Jedi. He's got this really optimistic, very innocent, in its worst sense, naive, in its best sense, innocent, view of the galaxy and the people in it. And this really comes out in the first planet they go to once they get the ship, that they land there, and I love the way that it's filmed. It's sort of this overload of the senses, where they've gone from this very clinical planet that sort of looks like suburbia to this what Obi-Wan, I guess, in old Ben would have called a wretched hive of scum and villainy. And they're walking through just the street vendors, And you sort of, as the viewer, it almost creates a sense of anxiety inside of you because so much is happening and so many people are talking to the kids and yelling at them. And the reason that happens is it overloads the senses. It's the first time they've been in a setting like that. And you see people trying to take advantage of them. You see people, you know, trying to, take them for their money and that sort of thing. And that all plays toward the greater themes of the show, which is the kids sort of shedding this sense of naivete, figuring out that, okay, not everybody in the galaxy is a good person. Not everybody is out there to help me, that there are people who will take advantage of me for their own ends, which is like Jod is the sort of the ultimate example of that. And so in that sense, I think it is a coming of age story in the sense that it is about I don't want to say the loss of innocence or the shedding of innocence, because that's not really what it is. They're still good kids by the end of the show, but it is a growing up there. It's sort of a losing of naivete, of having their edges sanded just a little bit. And I think for a little slice of Star Wars, that's a little different from what we've seen. It's enough. I don't need these kids to go on Anakin's journey. I do not need to follow them from childhood to adolescence to adulthood to end of their life. I don't have to do that with these kids. And one of the things I like about the show is that it does feel very complete by the time the credits roll. I think that may surprise some people who are looking for more, you know, overt ties to the larger films, kind of like The Mandalorian ended up doing by bringing in characters like Luke. You know, this show doesn't do that, and I actually really appreciate that. This show could not have a season two, and it would feel complete. It would feel like that's a whole story told, and there's room left to explore later. There's room enough for the character of Jod to come back in a different capacity. There's room enough for the kids to come back in a different capacity. But I'm not going to feel like I have been robbed of character arcs or a narrative if that does not happen. And in this day and age where everything is about sequels and building for, you know, a new universe or another property or another, sub-series or something like that, I appreciate that this is a very contained story that knows exactly the kind of story it wants to tell. It's content being exactly that, and it tells it and has a lot of fun doing it.
So what are some of the themes in Skeleton Crew, you know, for the Christian apologist? And we just talked about, you know, just their coming of age, not in like a sexualized way when people think of those kinds of stories, but more about having to really grapple with their own character and with choices that they have to make, moral choices. And so what are some of these themes that are part of this story and that are part of all Star Wars stories that, you know, the Christian apologists can talk to about people who are very much invested in the story? And by the way, you know, years ago on the Postmodern Realities podcast, we did a podcast and an article about kind of geek conventions. You know, can you share Christ at all those anime and Star Wars conventions and Star Trek conventions and video gaming conventions? And pretty much at any of those kinds of conventions, there are these folks, and more there's younger generations are just so enamored with Star Wars. So I think this is very relevant to the Christian apologist of all ages.
Yeah, absolutely. If we're just going to talk about Skeleton Crew, what can the apologists latch on to here? Obvious themes of loyalty and courage. Seeing the way that the kids work through their differences with each other and remain loyal to each other. That's a huge component, especially for younger kids. Finding out who your friends are and then being willing to sacrifice on their behalf, which, you know, echoes Jesus's own words, greater love hath none than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. So in that sense, you can latch on to that idea. And I actually do think from that, you can walk someone, even a kid, you can walk them fairly easily into the gospel. You know, who has been loyal to you, cared enough about you, loved you enough that he laid down his life for you? You know, that's a fairly easy thing to get to from that. But to press a little bit deeper onto those themes, I do think it is important for the apologist, especially, to look at the growing up that the kids do, to look at the shedding of naivete and understanding that, you know, Christians are supposed to be the most clear-eyed people on the face of the planet, and we call sin for what it is. Are there moments where Jod helps the kids, regardless of his motivation, selfish or not? Sure. Are there moments where he is maybe loyal to these kids, regardless of his motivation? Sure. But then when you account for his motivations, does that make him right? That's the question. By the end of the show, does Jod make the right decision? Does he choose redemption? No, he doesn't. He doubles down on this. Okay, well, what do we do with that person that we're going to meet in life? Because so often in the Christian life, and this is where I think coming of age stories in general are actually very important and powerful. So often, especially in modern contexts, Christians have what I call, you know, the John Conley view of the Christian life, which is, you know, John Conley who sang that old country song, Rose Colored Glasses, right? They put these rose tinted glasses on and they look at the world, and they cannot see anything wrong, right? It's the airbrushed view of the Christian life. It's very sentimental. It's very sentimental. And you and I have talked at length on this podcast, I won't rehearse it here, how sentimentality really is sort of the ultimate enemy right now of the 21st century American church. It is not atheism. It is not, even, you know, since Bonhoeffer, everybody talks about cheap grace, nana. It is sentimentality. It is this airbrushed view of the Christian life that if you just come to Jesus, all of your problems turn into, you know, these things that you simply laugh away. Coming of age stories uniquely are geared toward absolutely annihilating that horrible theology. The theology of the New Testament is a theology of suffering. This is something that we look at with the kids that I teach. The theology of Paul is not, the Corinthians actually get this backwards, right? The Corinthians are the ones who sort of take this airbrushed view of the Christian life and start using it as an excuse to sin. Well, what's a sin for me? What's a sin for that guy out there isn't a sin for me because I'm a Christian. It doesn't apply. They hear Paul, and this is, you know, likely due to the influence of the Judaizers, they hear Paul saying, okay, now that you're a Christian, it is permissible for you to sin, which, by the way, is the same thing that Paul is being accused of teaching in the book of Romans by the Judaizers. So where does the theology come from? I think it's pretty clear. They're hearing Paul say, go out and sin so that good may come of it. It's okay. And Paul writes his letters to the Corinthians saying, wait a minute, what did you mince? What words did you mince when I was trying to teach you these things? This isn't a license to go out and sin. It's a license to be aware, to call sin for what it is, not in the world, because that's where sin is. He literally says, I wasn't telling you to separate yourself from the world because that's where people are. I was telling you to be aware of it in your own midst. I was telling you to take care of it in your own midst. And sort of the underlying principle there, to use that language, is that the Christian is supposed to be the most clear-eyed person on the face of the planet. We are supposed to be the ones who call sin for what it is, not the person who airbrushes everything over and says, oh, well, my God is a teddy bear. Let me go hug him. It's all going to be okay. The Christian is supposed to be very sober-minded in that sense. And part of these coming of age stories, why I like them so well, is that in many ways, it's these kids' first time having to do that. And what's wild, even in the Skeleton Crew story, is that the kids are better at it than the adults. You see this by the end of it. When the kids come back home and Jod is posing, you know, he's always playing his cards as they're dealt. And he just happens to get a lucky hand all the time. He shows up. He just happens to have a lightsaber that he picked up along the way. He's got these force abilities. So he shows up to Ad-Aten, and everybody's like, oh my goodness, a Jedi. A Jedi has rescued our kids. And he rolls with it. I mean, he just rolls right with their own naivety. And the kids are, you know, looking at each other like, are our parents really this dumb, you know, that they're just going to buy this goofy story? And so you see in that last episode, which is very well done and very funny, where the kids are trying to clue their parents in, like, this is too easy. Like, this guy is not who he says he is. And the parents just cannot seem to figure out what the kids are trying to tell them until much later on. But that's where I think those stories, especially for the Christian apologist, you can latch onto that and really say something profound that goes beyond just obvious parallelism. Oh, this story is like Jesus and these kids are like this. And it goes beyond that and says, okay, you actually can say something important based on this show about Christianity, about the faith, about the state of the church today, about a biblical idea. So yeah, I think there are some major themes that the apologist can latch onto and develop from Skeleton Crew. Absolutely.
Well, now on a fun note, kind of a rapid fire question I have for Cole. I think I've asked him before about his favorite Star Wars film, but today I want to know, what is your favorite Star Wars character?
You know, this will be an interesting one. I've grown very partial to Count Dooku. I really have. And that is due in large part to the way that his story is told in the animated series Tales of the Jedi, where we actually see him as a Jedi who becomes disillusioned with the Jedi for good reason. And then I also recently, I went through the audiobook Jedi Lost, which is about Dooku's years as a Jedi and eventually how he comes to leave the Order. And while I don't think he's a character I would say you emulate, I think Dooku, he's a great warning for what happens when you have a person who is becoming disillusioned with an institution, who sees the flaws and tries to point out the flaws, but the pride of the people in the institution and their pride in the institution keep them from listening to him. And I think there's a serious question to ask of, you know, would Dooku's fate be what it was if only the people had listened to him, if only the Jedi had listened to him? So I think Dooku is an extremely nuanced character. I think he's very well written. So, you know, and I'm sure my favorites are going to change, but at this juncture, I'm doing a lot with Dooku. So that's kind of where I am right now.
Well, that was a deep cut. So thanks again for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Always appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to episode 430 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's conversation was with our guest, Cole Burgett, who has written a TV series review for the Christian Research Journal. His review is called Space Pirates and Treasure Planets, a review of Star Wars Skeleton Crew. You can read it for free without a paywall at equip.org. That's equip.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Handegraff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.